Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This week on Rewind, your week in review.
As the number of COVID positive tests in Wisconsin set daily records, state officials say keep that mask on. Governor Tony Evers says school administrators, teachers, and parents are making tough district-by-district decisions on how to soon reopen school. A record $10 million was spent on April's Supreme Court election. And let's hear what three speakers at the in-person Republican State Convention last weekend had to say. Rewind, your week in review for July 17.
I'm Steve Wallers.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
Well, we are going to talk some hardcore politics, but before we do that, we have to get to two topics that are dominating discussions across Wisconsin. First, of course, we're all watching, all Wisconsinites are watching the number of COVID-19 positives, the positive rates. So let's focus on that first, JR. Let's talk about the new plea that we not that Wisconsin not become Florida and Texas and Arizona and California. So let's just go over a little bit of what state officials were saying before we hear from two state officials. We set five of the seven last days. Last week, we hit either 800 or 900 positives. And Health Services Secretary Andrea Palm said that was a result of significant community spread. We're on the travel advisory lists of New York, New Jersey, Connecticut. And the mayor of Chicago says she's thinking seriously about adding us. And the Milwaukee Common Council unanimously added a face mask requirement. And I was struck, JR, three northern counties, Ashland, Bayfield, Iron, have now adopted emergency advisories asking for masks when they're indoors. What's your take before we hear from Andrea Palm and Dr. Westergaard, JR?
Couple things to keep in mind. At this point, we have no statewide policy. That's in part because the state Supreme Court struck down the extended stay-at-home order under Governor Evers. And after that happened, the Evers administration declined to promulgate an emergency rule and working with lawmakers to try and address COVID-19. So we are basically a patchwork right now of proposals. Look at places elsewhere that are having spikes. We're seeing statewide mask orders coming in some, quite frankly, some conservative states that maybe you wouldn't expect it. This has become quite a political issue about whether to wear a mask or whether not to wear one, in part because President Trump early on was kind of put off about wearing a mask and kind of downplayed things. It's become political, and I don't see at this point a prospect of a statewide policy, in part because the governor has said he doesn't think he has the authority. If he did, he was pretty sure lawmakers would sue him over it, and the Supreme Court would strike it down.
JR, let me ask you, though. If we hit a very tragic number, if we hit 1,000, 1,200 new cases a day, do you think the governor would be forced to reassess his, I don't think I have powers, I think my powers were gutted by the Supreme Court ruling? Do you think he'd have to reassess that politically?
Good question. He brought up on one of the conference calls that he had a business person tell him, you know, do a mask policy. The governor said, I'm not sure that I can. He said, do it anyway. You know, just push it out there. And we're seeing people, I mean, Barry Alvarez, doing like a public service announcement, like wear a mask. We're hearing from people left and right. If you want to see college football, you want to see high school sports this way, you want to see schools reopen, put a mask on. But if you go anywhere in public right now and go see, if schools have a policy, you see a mishmash of people who are wearing them and who are not. So it's really, for the health experts, it's something holding us back from getting a hold of the curve right now is going on.
But increasingly, retailers are taking, they're preempting local governments and they're saying, thou shalt wear. I mean, the CVS and the Woodman's, et cetera, and et cetera. So they're kind of leading where some public officials are very hesitant to do so, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Now let's hear from the Health Services Secretary Andrea Palm and Dr. Ryan Westergaard, what they said just about the spike in Wisconsin and how to repeat. We don't want to be Florida and Texas and Arizona and California. Please.
Like the spring, similar to now, we are seeing outbreaks in states around this country that we certainly don't want to get to that point. And so we need to do the things that are necessary to reflatten the curve and to prevent ourselves from getting to the place where our hospital systems and our frontline healthcare workers are really unable to meet the demands of patients that need hospital level care. And so I think it's as simple as that. We can look to folks who are a few weeks ahead of us, recognize that this virus means business, that it spreads rapidly, that it continues to be contagious, and then do the things together that we know we need to do to stop the spread, flatten the curve, and not get ourselves in a place that is really difficult to manage.
The link between social interaction and particularly close contact, particularly indoors, and disease transmission just gets stronger and stronger. You know, we always presume this would be the case because what we know about respiratory viruses in general, but we're seeing the same story get told, is that when people interact more in indoor settings and don't wear face masks and larger numbers of people get together, that drives transmission. So we haven't learned this. It wasn't something that is surprising or that we didn't know to be true before, but the evidence continues to get stronger. And the more we see it, the more certainty we can make these recommendations that these are the things that we need to do. We need to wear masks when we're indoors. We need to limit close contact. It's going to make, and frankly, those are our only tools right now. So the story is getting stronger and the evidence is getting stronger, and we're learning that those lessons over every day.
The next debate, JR, that's raging across Wisconsin is raging is the wrong, the very serious discussions going on in 421 all of our school districts on how to reopen. As you know, I've been interviewing candidates for the Assembly and the Senate, and I interviewed many of them are now members of the school board. They're telling me that this is that ringing hours-long discussions. How should we open? When should we open? It's just pretty amazing. And now some of the backdrop, the Milwaukee Public Schools, they want to open only virtually and then fade into in-person when our COVID numbers go down. Some of our rural school districts are asking to start early. The governor said in his Tuesday briefing, he's asked, are we going to have to cut state aid? $4.9 billion, according to Senator Mark Lyons' broadcast this week, in state aid to schools. He says, I hope to avoid that. So you have this ringing discussion going on in 421 different school districts. How shall we reopen? How shall we reopen? When shall we reopen? Your thoughts, please.
My kids are in Madison schools. Just got an email just a little while ago that they're going to go all virtual until at least October 30th. Don't know what that means for sports yet and those kinds of things. But this is not just about education, although that's obviously the focus. It's also about how do you help people get back to work. And that's why it's got a political undertone to it, because for President Trump, he needs schools to be open this fall for in-person instruction to help parents of young children to have some place to basically watch their kids so they can go off and go back to work. If you have kids who are not old by themselves, how do you go back and do your job? And that's a difficult situation. So there's that piece of it. Now, the education piece, there's a debate about, looking at COVID-19 numbers, kids seem to be less susceptible to it, or it's less damaging for them, so they should be okay. But then there's the other piece about teachers, support staff, administrators. It might be okay for kids, people argue, but what about the teachers? Are you putting them at risk? The Madison Teachers Union, the day or two before, the district said we're going to go back to virtual October 30th, demanded we start virtually, essentially. There's safety concerns. So there's that health piece, but there's also the political piece, because there's an economic piece to this discussion.
Well, and part of it is Governor Evers at Tuesday's briefing said, we hope the federal government comes up with more cash to help school districts pay for some of these very enormous additional COVID costs. There's that piece. And you mentioned one other part of this debate is volunteers like me. I used to volunteer once a week at Mendota Elementary School Literacy. I don't think I'll be volunteering anymore, and I'll miss those kids. So you're right. It's playing out in so many different levels. But talk to me about the political side of this debate, JR. Your thoughts?
Obviously, there's also the one Is there a one-size-fits-all approach? The federal government's trying, the Trump administration is trying to find ways to pressure schools to open. Now, it's interesting to watch if you're a cynic like me, because for years you've heard Republicans talk about the need for local control when it comes to education. Now with the federal government trying to force schools to open, I'm not sure that they have the power, the purse string to actually force that to happen, but the Trump administration wants it to happen, again, to get parents back to work. I got to watch how this plays out and how, what goes on going forward. But if we're also kind of at this interesting point in the economy where we have the spike of cases of COVID-19. We were having that V-shaped recovery for job numbers.
Yep.
How's that going to play out? And with voters, they kind of make up their minds with the economy around Labor Day, in election year. You know, that report you get around Labor Day, maybe October you can shape it as well. But if we see the unemployment rate go back up in August and September, that's going to be a problem for the president.
Yeah, yeah, it is. And you've got two kids in the Madison school districts. I've got four grandchildren in the Waukesha school district waiting on the answers on their reopening. Now let's hear from Governor Evers and how he framed this whole issue, this whole controversy, this whole statewide debate on Tuesday's DHS briefing. Please.
The schools did receive information from the Department of Public Instruction, which coordinated not only with the Department of Health Services, but with education groups all across the state, laid out several different options for people that are people locally can use to make the decisions. It's going to look different in different parts of the state, and we're already seeing it. Milwaukee Public Schools is looking to start the year virtually and then morph into a more regular situation. Our role in this would be to, if things are completely out of control, to suggest that they not open. I'm not sure that there's the ability anymore from the state level to make that decision anyway. But the bottom line is parents should plan. Your school districts are saying it right now. They plan to open. I see it all across the state. So they need to be in contact with their local school districts. Child care is obviously an important thing. I know that back in the days, but I would be prepared to send your children to school.
I just want to highlight something Governor Evers said in that clip. He said, if COVID-19 worsens, and his words, completely out of control, schools may not reopen again. That's a very amazing and frightening scenario for those of us with loved ones, for our whole K-12 system. Okay, Newt.
We all want in-person education. It's that tension of, can you do it safely, that's going on right now.
Thanks, JR. That's a good PS. Okay, now we get to some real hardball politics. The April election for the Supreme Court, won by Justice-elect Jill Karofsky, a Dane County judge, cost a total, well, cost is the wrong term, a record $10 million was spent on that. Let's run down the numbers, courtesy of WisPolitics and the Democracy Campaign. The campaign of Justice-elect Karofsky, $2.7 million, including $1.4 million, from the State Democratic Party. The campaign of the incumbent Justice Dan Kelly, who was defeated, spent $2.1 million and got $320,000 of that, almost $321,000, from the Republican Party. The third-party candidate who was eliminated in the primary, Marquette professor Ed Falone, spent $193,000. Third-party groups, more than $5 million. Let's run those down quickly. Who were the biggest spenders, according to the Democracy Campaign? $1.9 million to help Karofsky by the Liberal of Wisconsin, Better Wisconsin Together Fund. $1 million to help Kelly by WMC. $900,000 to help Kelly by Republican State Leadership Committee. JR, you reported on some of these numbers. What surprised you, other than did this one $10 million, was that about $2 million more than last year's?
Honestly, nothing surprised me. I went back and looked.
nothing.
I looked at the end of March. Well, looking at the end of March, early April, about like what was happening with fundraising, and I was looking out, going, okay, Karofsky and Kelly had this much left in the bank. I've seen this much spent. We're talking north of $9 million already. So $10 million didn't surprise me. Also, I don't think this record's going to last long. This is why. because Karofsky joined the court, narrows it from a 5-2 conservative majority to 4-3, right?
Yeah.
2023 is our next election. Conservative Justice, Chief Justice, Pat Rogers is up for another term. She would be, I think, 82 when that election is held. There's speculation about whether she'll seek another 10-year term or not. If she doesn't run, you're talking an open seat for control of the court. That will make $10 million look like pocket change if we're talking about control of the court. Because remember, what's that court dealt with in the last couple of years? Things like the lame duck session. Next year could deal with redistricting. The powers of the Attorney General and Governor Tony Evers. The extent of the partial veto authority of the governor. We're talking major issues that have huge impacts for all kinds of sectors of the economy. So if this is about control of the court, you're talking big money coming in 2023.
Well, I was struck. Those three major rulings, safer at home, lame duck, and then the one that just released a week ago. Those within 8 weeks. But okay, JR, while we're talking about money, you also reported that the governor of the Wisconsin Democratic Party raised $10 million. But if I read your report right, 1/4 of that, $2.5 million, came from the Democratic governor of Illinois. Huh? What's that about?
Democrats are beating Republicans at their own game. If you go back and look at the Republican rewrite of campaign finance laws about 5 years ago, there were all these federal court decisions about restrictions we had and on the books for how money could flow in the campaigns. At the time, Republicans crafted a law that said there'll be no limits on energy contributions to political parties, but also no limits on transfers from parties to candidates. The argument was doing that would strengthen parties and encourage donors to give money to parties rather than these kind of shadowy interest groups, we call them C4s, and they'd be disclosed. That'd be a good thing for democracy, right? Well, Republicans had the power of Governor Scott Walker in the governor's office at the time to help that party raise money. Now it's reversed. Now you have Governor Evers in the East Wing. You have a state chair in Ben Wickler who's got national contacts because of his work for MoveOn.org. You have a good small dollar network already because of the fights over Act 10 and the ensuing recall elections and the perfect political storm now with Wisconsin being one of the tipping points in the country, which encourages big Democratic donors who are terrified of a second Trump campaign term, say, okay, I'll give money. Where should I give it? Well, Wisconsin is a great receiving point right now. And they're getting big time donations. J.B. Pritzker, $2.49 million to be precise. I counted 10 more donors of at least six figures in that 3-month period alone who accounted for like $5.7 million of the $7.5 million in the state account. Now, don't forget the parties have state accounts and federal accounts. So you mix it all together, you get your $10 million bucks raised by the party and $12 million cash on hand. That is huge. Also, because this is a ramping up fundraising period, but not the prime fundraising period. I had one Dem tell me that whatever they raise this 3 months, you start looking at what's going to happen in the next 4 months, it'll go up by that much more because we're really going to get the crux of the campaign.
Well, and the governor said, look, I spent nights dialing for dollars. And did he do that arguing, look, the Republicans won a veto-proof majority in both houses, and we're about to hear Republican John Nygren talk about that at the convention. But was that his sales pitch when he's dialing for dollars, JR?
That was part of it, plus it was a tipping point. I mean, if you look at the governor's personal campaign report, it went down a little bit from where it was the previous 6 months. But the governor and his staff say, hey, he was focused on the party. And I was told by one operative that, you know, it's great to have Ben Wickler, who has this kind of great plan for Wisconsin for the party. I mean, give credit to Ben again. But having the governor making those calls adds a kind of like legitimate, like he's vouching for him essentially. Like, yeah, this guy knows what he's doing. We've got a good plan in place. I'm making the ask for X. Oh, by the way, for Evers, after the November election is done, if the party has money left over, they can make a big transfer to the governor to help goose his fundraising into 2021, 22. And don't forget, the future of campaigns with what's going on in the structure now is not just what the governor raised. It's the governor plus the party.
Yeah.
Just like with the president and the RNC together, that's what you want to look at.
Yeah.
The
yeah.
governor now with those unlimited donations to the party plus unlimited transfers can use the state party as a way to really raise money and help, you know, propel him toward 2022.
Okay, that's a very good point. Now, more hardcore politics. Let's hear from three speakers at last Saturday's Republican State Convention in person in Green Bay. Congressman Mike Gallagher, Senate Majority Leader Fitzgerald, Joint Finance Co-Chairman John Nygren, please.
I believe our children will look back on this moment and ask where we stood. So let them say that we stood up against the mobs trying to erase our history. We say that we refuse to kneel before the mob. We refuse to let this great country crumble before our eyes. And we utterly reject the lie that America is an evil, racist country, because we know that we, though not perfect, are still the good guys.
I think the governor was a reluctant candidate initially, somebody that had some statewide name recognition. And I think the Democrats went to him and said, listen, you're the only one who can take on Scott Walker. So when you have a reluctant candidate who then was fortunate enough to be elected, I don't think he wanted the job. And quite honestly, I don't believe that the governor is up to the job.
The veto-proof majority in both houses is within reach.
Right.
It is within reach.
Okay, JR, thanks to the live streaming by Wisconsin IU, and I watched all those speakers. I was kind of surprised. Were you at the raw meat of Congressman Mike Gallagher? He led it off. We just heard it talking about the mobs. He had not been that strident, but he was the chair of the convention. Did that surprise you, his tone?
No, I mean, the convention essentially embraced the rhetoric of the president lately, where he's trying to make his one of the pillars of his reelection campaign, the culture wars, right? So the mobs, tearing the statues, you're not safe. It all plays into that reelection strategy going on right now of making voters afraid of Joe Biden and what it would mean, where the president says, I'm a law and order kind of guy. You can trust me to keep you safe. So there's that going on. Plus, too, he's not talking to the average voter in his speech. Gallagher is addressing the base of the base. I mean, and the whole part of my political conventions is, one, to deliver a message, but also to the public, but also, two, to give the bait, these people who stuff the envelopes, you know, man the phone banks, give out the yard signs, give them a boost of energy, adrenaline going into the fall. So He was trying to pump those guys up and get them ready, and that he delivered exactly what they're looking for.
Well, you and I talked to Republican Chair Andrew Hitt a week ago. He said our goal was to hold an in-person convention. Sure, the attendance was down. I think 322 delegates registered. There was hand sanitizer and masks available. Few of those actually wore the masks. The red meat speeches came from Gallagher and Grossman and Tom Tiffany and Brian Steil. Speaker Voss was not there because of a wedding commitment. Senator Ron Johnson was celebrating his 65th birthday somewhere out in the West. I was at one point, Senator Tiffany in his speech said, it has come to the point where protesters were attacking Democratic Senator Tim Carpenter, who was attacked on June 24th. But the Republicans did hold an in-person convention, so kudos to them, JR.
Well, we'll see. I mean, obviously, Democrats are wondering if this was even safe to do and if there are going to be any spread of COVID-19 because of it. So obviously, you hope that doesn't happen.
Right, right.
But really, the focus now is the national conventions. We're seeing more and more signs the Milwaukee convention is going to not be what it was supposed to be. It's going to be basically a virtual event with Vice President Biden here, his running mate here, but not many other people coming to Wisconsin for the convention. So there's that going on. Republicans struggling to figure out how Jacksonville is going to work because you've got all these restrictions going in place down there. And oh, by the way, there's talk about having the president accept the nomination during outdoor event in August in Florida, which a little balmy that time of year down there. So we'll see how those logistics work out. But it's tough to have a big event politically in this environment. How do you pull it off and stay safe? It's a challenge for anybody.
Yeah. And just to PS, the national news organizations, New York Times and others, are reporting now that Democratic members of Congress and their staffers are told, don't come to Milwaukee for what's left of a narrowed Democratic National Convention, which, as JR just said, would include Mr. Biden and his vice presidential nominee. Okay, JR, new topic. I was really intrigued. The Trump administration said, if you're an international student and you're only taking online courses, we don't want you in the United States. So I was really fascinated by the impact. What are international students worth to our UW campuses. And in a filing this week by the Wisconsin Department of Justice, that said on only five campuses, international students were worth $213 million, one-fifth of $1 billion. I just want to run that down. UW-Madison, $168 million paid by international students in tuition and fees, $18.8 million for housing. UW-Milwaukee, $21.5 million in tuition, $5.1 million for housing. Stout, $2.7 million. Stevens Point, $2.2. Green Bay, $1.4. Am I wonking out on this, JR? Were you surprised at those numbers?
I didn't realize how large a chunk of change they accounted for, but it's long been one of the secrets of the UW system. State lawmakers are constantly saying we want in-state students to be on our campuses because it's the University of Wisconsin system. But with the cuts in aid from the state to the university, or the reduction in the percentage of money coming from the state, they've relied more and more on out-of-state and international students to fill that void, because you can charge. There's a tuition freeze on in-state undergraduates in Wisconsin. There's not one on out-of-state students or international students. So they are a way to raise revenue. You can't raise it off of in-state students.
Okay. JR, I just want to do 2 minutes on this back and forth on the unemployment insurance, the jobless claims. Democrats came out with a package of 8 bills that they said would speed up and make it easier to for those that have applied for unemployment. But Workforce Secretary Caleb Frostman said of the 4.2 million claims since March 2, 75% have been paid, 12% have been denied, and the other 13% are pending. Well, these 13% pending are in legislators' districts across Wisconsin. So we have the Republicans arguing for a bridge loan. You have this back and forth. Now the Democrats have a package. Assembly Majority Leader Steinke says, yeah, the Democrats have a package, because the Evers administration has failed. Give me 1 minute of your take on this back and forth before we do stock picks, please.
One question I heard about the package at Dems this week is what took so long. The Evers administration has been getting beat up about this for weeks now. Why not have something out earlier? Democrats have tried to argue that Republicans set up the system to fail because they did not update the computer system used for processing claims in 8 years they're in office, despite knowing there are problems with it. And two, adding requirements for the adjudication process. So part of the hangup is the going through these claims, making sure that you are actually eligible for unemployment. That's an issue. For Republicans, it is a treasure trove of hits saying, look, you guys aren't getting this done. The backlog is not going to be fixed until they say October possibly. That's not acceptable. And one thing I've heard repeatedly was the Evers administration moved too slowly originally to head this off. Now, nobody could have anticipated what we actually saw in the millions of weeks sought for unemployment. They probably should have known, though, by issuing a stay-at-home order, we were going to have a surge in cases. They could have marshaled resources earlier that would have helped this maybe a little bit. And also, the governor's been somewhat tone-deaf and not, like, personally investing, like, hey, we're going to fix this. I feel your pain. I understand there's a problem. We're going to get to it. His baseline's been, have patience, please. We assure you, if you're eligible, you're going to get your money.
Well, and the agency, DWD, yesterday put out a press release saying we are reassigning 100 more to process these jobless claims. Okay.
500 bodies in UI pre-March 15th. They're now at nearly 1,900.
Right. Okay. But all this discussion gives you about a minute and a half for your stock picks. Go.
So rising, Derek Van Orden, a Republican candidate seeking the 3rd Congressional District. He outraised incumbent Ron Kind. Not quite 2-1, but by around 2-1, but a healthy chunk of change by $500,000. Also up in the air with the TV ad touting his background as a Navy SEAL. Now he's got a primary. Jesse Evan, a PR professional from Eau Claire, is also running. But the focus has been on Van Orden. He's got a couple things going for him. The background is a SEAL. He's got some national connections. He can get up on Fox News and draw some attention. So it's good for him. Here's the issue. Republicans have been targeting Ron Kind for a while. But Ron Kind, in part because President Trump won his district by 4.5 points in 16 when Kind wasn't opposed. Kind won re-election in 18 by like 60% of the vote. He's got $3.1 million in the bank. He's in good shape. Okay. The whole thing is, can President Trump do better than losing Wisconsin by 8 points? If he gets within strike, if it's a 1 point race like it was last, or less than 1 point like last time, he's got a shot. If it's not, Derek Orr is not going to beat Ron Klein this fall.
Okay, we're in overtime. Go to Mixed and Falling.
Let's say the fundraising real quick. If you look at the top dozen races, Democrats are outraising Republicans, which is a good sign for Democrats. Looking at the campaign committees, Robin Voss, still the best fundraiser of the four leaders. But the prowess of the Democratic Party is helping narrow the gap among the campaign committees because the party is sending money to Senate Democrats and Senate and Assembly Democrats, helping them level the playing field a little bit. And finally, following Stasha Brzezinski,
yeah,
incumbent freshman lawmaker from Green Bay, sexually harassed a Capitol staffer at a Madison bar. He was outraised by his opponent this fundraising period, Christina Shelton. She's been endorsed now by the top three Assembly Democrats. Also, the one Assembly Democrat who's been backing Stosh, Amanda Stuck, withdrew her endorsement this week. The primary's gotten too divisive. She's not endorsing Shelton, saying she's going to remain neutral. But also, on top of all that, two of the biggest Democrats in Green Bay, Eric Genrich, the mayor, Dave Hansen, retiring state senator, backed Shelton. That's not what you want if you're an incumbent fighting, you know, a challenge to you in a Me Too era when you start to harass the staff.
Okay, but just to PS on that, when I did a campaign interview with Stasha Brzezinski, he looked at me and said, I've been sober for 8 months. I'm not excusing his conduct. I'm just saying that. Okay, we're almost out of time. Next week, Wisconsin and I will continue interviewing Milwaukee area legislative candidates. And I'm Steve Walters.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
That's Rewind for July 17.
Rewind. Your Week in Review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.